You're listening to CPR, communitypublicradio.org. And this is Weekday World. I'm your host, Don DeBar. With a report of some of the news and events of the past 24 hours from the CPR Newsroom. From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. Russian President Vladimir Putin's State of the Union speech, given on Thursday, was the talk of the town in Washington Friday. But we decided to take it back to Moscow to discuss this with our analyst, Mark Sloboda, who's a senior lecturer at Moscow State University. Well, Mark, a rather interesting speech by President Putin yesterday, and of course is being completely mischaracterized here and presented ahistorically, as is the norm for the American media. So why don't you tell us what it looked like to you sitting in Moscow watching it yesterday?
Sure. Thanks for having me, Don. It's always an honor and a pleasure to be on CPR.
Our pleasure.
I think this was a monumental speech in multiple ways. I think this is actually two different speeches, right? There is a more typical, we should say, State of the Union speech, although unlike a typical State of the Union speech, instead of kind of rhetorical self-aggrandizement, as is, you know, reassuring everyone how great the United States is and everything, Putin very directly, very specifically, with a ton of facts, PowerPoint presentations coming up behind him, more sophisticated than PowerPoint, but right. Visual presentations,
right.
Putting up the graphs, all the numbers, everything he was talking about, highlighting, you know, what they have done, what the situation is now, after the economic sanctions and where everything has been over the last few years, how the government has recovered, what the problems still are, and then he projected a very detailed plan for the future, which he specifically said, this is, he believes, what any Russian president whoever is elected next month really needs to follow through on, mm-hmm. right? And this is a very detailed plan of the future. It's ambitious. He laid out exactly why he thinks it's possible. And to be said, it must be said, Putin will be reelected next month. Mm-hmm. The most recent pre-election polling shows him at 69.5% of people that are likely voters who will choose to vote for Putin for reelection. Right. No other candidate is, you know, much above 10%, if that. Maybe for the communist candidate, the communist businessman Grudinin, who is famous for his strawberry Holko's farms right. outside the, Moscow.
Right.
He wouldn't be my candidate for the Communist Party, right. but we'll leave that for the election.
That's right.
We'll discuss that in greater detail. But even the liberal pro-Western fringe opposition in Russia, right? The shall we say, the eternal, possibly 5%, although now it looks even less than that. Even their polling, right. and I take that with a grain of salt. I don't trust any methodology that comes from. Even their polling actually shows that Putin has more support than in the government polling. The government polling says about 70%. They say about 73%.
Right.
And it puts their own support lower than the government polling puts theirs, down below 2%, like, you know, less even than 2%, you know, down to the close to 1%. So if you don't believe the government polling, right, if you don't believe international pre-election polling, that's fine. Even the liberal pro-Western opposition's polling gives Putin better numbers than the government's own polling does. So right. his re-election is pretty much guaranteed. So right. he will have every chance to put this plan into action. He focuses on the big economic goal moving forward. He has several different goals: demographic, you know, Russia's population, contrary to what President Obama seemed to believe just a few years ago, has been growing during every year of Obama's presidency, in fact, and continues, you know, it's slight growth, it has to be said, but, you know, when we're comparing to, you know, other European countries,
Germany,
the
example,
graying right. phenomena across right. first world countries around right. the world is actually quite impressive. Right. And it's no small part in due to government programs that have provided money and encouraged families to have two or even three children. And myself, I see it in Moscow all the time. I'm always amazed
right.
at the number of children running around.
You know, one of the things is that people can afford to do it. I mean, you know, when you're living under conditions of austerity that look like they're only going to get worse, it does not make you say to, you know, to your spouse, hey, let's have some more kids.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's one of the, you know, the primary reasons, of course, for the big demographic dip during the 1990s
right.
when despair and economic collapse hit the country and everything.
Right.
But alone, economic recovery is not enough. Right. It helps. But it increased programs for immigration myself being one of those.
Right,
along with
right.
Programs to provide money and benefits, you know, again, increasingly to families with more than one child have been a big benefit to that. But let's talk about the economy, because I think the bigger focus of the speech is there. And this is a nearly 2-hour speech. And I would say about 70% of it is directed at domestic audience, right. laying out the where we are now and where we want to go in the future. And a big part of that is right. economics. And he promises, or he sets the target of increasing GDP per capita. GDP adjusted for purchasing power parity, right? There's a big distinction between these two terms. GDP is often presented as some kind of measure to make Russia look like, you know, Nigeria with snow
right.
or, you know,
right.
or something like that. GDP is a number that is often trotted out and by itself it has very little meaning whatsoever. When you take a look at GDP per purchasing power parity,
right,
which is an actual measure for determining a company. Again, in isolation, in itself, you know, you need some other context as well, sure. But is a much better number to look at, and that puts Russia as the fifth or sixth largest economy, mm-hmm. you know, depending on the last year, right neck right. and neck with Germany, and you know, right. projected to overpass them. So right. that gives us a much more realistic grounding, right? Russia is not, you know, the first, second economy in the world. That's China and the United States, right? But they are definitely in the top five, and anyone who tries to you know, project them as Nigeria with snow, or their economy is smaller than Italy's, or something like that, is just ridiculous. It's an isolated statistic, completely out of any context and connection with reality. So he wants to increase GDP, adjusted per person, personal purchasing power parity, per capita by 50%, which right away, yep. my first reaction was that seems like a pretty big goal, and mm-hmm. you better have some pretty strong goals, some pretty strong plans to develop it that much. And a big part of what he laid out for why he believes this is an ambitious but possible goal is how much in the last few years, what they have worked on is building all the preparations towards a rapid economic growth in the early 2020s. And he lays this out in a very detailed way, like you would expect an economist to do, right? So this might be over the heads of a lot of people, but he talked about how they've decoupled from the West and basically made the country sanction proof. He talks about how they've decoupled the economy from energy prices, where energy prices will always be, and high energy prices will always be of benefit to the economy and allow certain goals to be achieved, that they are not required for the budget, and that the resource dependency that, again, is also often falsely presented by Russia, they've decreased it even further just in the last 4 years. 4 years ago, despite what anyone says, it was about 15-17% of the GDP. Mm. That's oil and gas and actually some other natural resources combined, which is nothing like Saudi Arabia or right. Norway or other countries like right, that right. that are also big energy producers. But it's now at 7% of GDP.
Right.
So by far the biggest sector of Russia's economy is services, as is the same for any of the big, you know, first world economies.
You know, and then on that just on that same question, by the way, of becoming sanction-proof, a substantial portion of the international trade in energy comes with that contract that they signed for natural gas with China. In other words, guaranteeing a nice piece of cash flow on that thing that is looked at as, okay, this is where, from time to time, as energy prices go up, we get this windfall. Yeah. That's like built in as a steady cash stream coming from the world's largest economy, or in any event, the largest consumer of those things.
And China has had some, is looking to get more gas from Russia, actually, just right. as Europe is, right, with Nord Stream 2 and so on. China wants more gas because several other possible avenues are fraught with risk. Gas from Iran, you know, there's the naval route there, and things with Central Asia on a one-to-one basis between China and Central Asian companies haven't worked out quite as well as they wanted. So China's demanding more and more Russian gas. And then now China's looking at not only oil and gas, but they're starting to look at piping Russian water.
Right.
Which, you know, is another climate change effect. So that's part of the decoupling. A big part of it, though, was about banks and in the inflation rate, and how Russia, how the government in the last few years has brought the inflation rate down to just over 2%. It's at a post-Soviet low. The economy is credibly stable. How they have managed to consolidate the banking sector, they've weeded out and allowed something that the U.S. would never do, and allowed weak banks. There's no such thing as too big to fail. Weak banks were allowed to die.
There you go.
Interestingly enough, while they made at least some measures to protect, you know, small consumers, but they've consolidated the banking sector. They've reduced the number of banks to some very solid banks with no overhanging debt. Russia's federal debt, by the way, is absolutely negligible.
Right.
But they've worked on reducing Russia's corporate debt as well over the last few years, so that Russia's corporations, including state corporations, aren't vulnerable as they were at the start of the sanctions that the right. U.S. tried to cut Russia off from the international financial sectors and right. so on. So they've dealt with that. So one of the big things they're looking at is now they're going to start decreasing the price for loans, in particular mortgages, corporate loans, and so on, from state banks and from guaranteed Asian and Middle East sectors that don't have to rely on Western finance. And they're really going to be pushing low-cost mortgages, which is one of the vehicles that he outlines for increasing economic activity from within the country.
Right.
Another thing they've looked at is how the government has really focused on decreasing or increasing its strength in the international polling of ease of doing business. And anyone who's lived here for any length of time can tell you, I think the anecdotes, you know, or at least give you some hint about how huge and unwieldy and annoying Russian bureaucracy could be. Well, they've vastly worked on that. I can see it here, even in local government services. But they've dropped Russia's ease of doing business in the last 8 years from 130th on the rank, 125th on the ranking, to like 30th.
Wow.
That's a huge job. They've done a lot to streamline, to encourage investment, right? Not only for Russian businesses, in particular small businesses, but of course in attempts to spur foreign investment, right? Mm-hmm. That's been a big problem with the sanctions from the U.S. and so on, at least from the West. But again, China and other Asian and Middle Eastern countries have been, you know, right. stepping in there and basically cutting the sanctions have done nothing so much as cutting Europe out of Russian market share. So,
right.
We have no tears in that regard. Mm. So all of this is towards the GDP. But he doesn't stop there. He also talks about the absolute need for Russia to move forward with the fourth industrial revolution. And he starts talking very sophisticated terms, laying out what Russia needs to increase the ease of development in AI, drones, blockchain for financial transactions. He was getting very detailed, very technological, and he talks about how, you know, these are crucial years and Russia cannot afford to fall behind in technology. In fact, he says that Russia's greatest threat, the greatest threat to Russia, the Russia's greatest enemy, is the threat of falling behind, and that will be his, you know, one of the primary focuses to make sure he doesn't. And the big thing is something I'm very glad to hear is increased education spending, something that has been negligent during most of Putin's previous administrations, something that one of my biggest criticisms of him so far. He seems to think now the economic conditions are stable enough and he wants to pile lots of money into science, technology, maths, and also provide money for young people to take basically internships with Russian companies, again, particularly in the technological and finance sectors. Now, I, being myself from the soft humanitarian social sciences side of it, I have to say that he doesn't seem to be putting much emphasis on culture or humanities and everything, things that are close to my heart.
Right.
But he's a very pragmatic person, and you know, he's focused on this education thing. So, as much as I can regret that, in terms of doing what he can to improve Russian lives, state power, and ensuring the country moves forward. When you have to prioritize, you know, he's probably right for that, however much I may personally regret that. But he's focused on science, technology, and math.
We're talking about Russia here, okay? If you have a stable economy and people doing well in a stable economy, there's going to be culture up the yin-yang. That's just in that's in the heart of that country. We're not talking about the United States, where a jack-in-the-box is going to spring up if you have some extra coin, okay? This is, you know, ballet, symphony, poetry, literature. This is Russia.
Well, I mean, there's a celebration of what has been, but, you know, innovation in creativity and the social sciences and the humanities, you know, that some extra money always helps there well. And then I'll be the first to say that Russian teachers in whatever fields are not paid enough. I hope that is part of the big part of this new program moving forward. So technology, education. He also talks infrastructure, something that Trump, you know, was elected in the United States on trying to talk a game and hasn't really been able to do much of anything on. Putin has really delivered on infrastructure building in Russia during the last eight years of his presidency, well, 4 years and, or 5 years, and then the terms before that, before Medvedev, before the, you know, the interim there. I mean, the number of when you're opening 70 new metro stations in the last few years in Moscow, something that seemed absolutely, you know, impossible to me on what is already one of the largest metro systems in the world, and in my opinion, simply the best in terms of ease and cost and the beauty of it and everything. They've done it, and they're continuing to build more. He wants to focus not just on Moscow and not just on the first tier cities, but he also wants to move beyond to the second and third tier cities, and in particularly the national roads, which Russia is the biggest country in the world by far, with a very unforgiving climate. That makes the damage to roads, continual. And connecting the country via roads is something that, you know, that happened with the Soviet Union, but was never quite as developed as it was. Russia's always relied more on trains, and Russia's train systems are quite good, and they have been improved, and they're well along the way to implementing high-speed trains across most of the country at this point. But he wants to concentrate on the roads, and he's looking at allocating double the road budget, which has also increased in recent years as well. And I have to say it's needed. But, you know, again, considering the size of the country, the climate, you know, as someone who comes from Pennsylvania, someone with the worst roads in the United States for so many years that I think they even stopped looking at it, even considering it, just so you can give someone else a chance to have the worst roads. And seeing the similar, you know, the hilly, cold, high truck traffic, you know, and everything, what damage it does to roads and then that type of – Russia's much worse, right? Much bigger. So I understand that. And of course, a big part of that is bringing down the corruption in the road building industries. So something that I think they've done corruption under Putin has definitely, you know, no one's going to say there isn't corruption in Russia or in any other country, but Putin has reduced corruption, and we can hope that he will look at it further. Of course, which he promises to do, but you know, we'll see about that.
Let me give people some context. It's eight time zones, Russia, right?
Yeah.
Okay, so that's a third of the linear surface of the planet. Okay, and the population of Russia is about shy of 150 million, and which is about half of the population of the United States. It's not even twice the population of Germany, which is like 70 or 80 or something, right? So, you know, you have like not a lot of people spread onto this massive. I mean, if you're going to connect one end to the other of the roads, that's a third of the way across the planet.
Yeah, well, that's part of the plans. So, He lays this all out in great detail. The English, first of all, RT had it live translation. You can watch the whole thing. It's a 2-hour speech if you want on RT.
Yeah, it's worth it.
Or the full Kremlin English official English transcript is out. It's on the president's page. It's easy to find. Or hit me up and I'll easily send you a link to it if you can't find it yourself. I think it's one of these important national speeches. But if we jump past this domestic content, which is all very interesting for Russians and everything, and in particularly light of the election coming up and everything, but the last third of the speech, I would say, is foreign policy and defense policy and in particular military policy, and it's directly at the United States.
Right.
And let's not mince words or anything there. And this speech, I think, the second part of this speech, I think, is as monumental as the 2007 Munich speech that Putin gave was. Warning. If you go back and look at that speech, and I think it's still crucial for understanding the world today, the geopolitical. This speech basically says, we warned you about it. And he's, in fact, Putin exactly says this. We tried to talk to you. Didn't want to listen to us.
Right.
Well, now you will hear us. And he said that explicitly in this speech. This second section here, Vasily Kashin at the Moscow's Higher School of Economics, and actually a very liberal school, not something neoliberal even, not my favorite school, not my type of favorite political representation there. But even he said of this speech, the speech can be represented by one huge middle finger. This part of it aimed at the United States.
Mm-hmm.
They declared a new Cold War on us. We accept. And that's what the second part of the speech is about.
Yep.
It is about a response to two things. It is about a response to the U.S. pulling out of the anti-ballistic missile treaty in 2001, something that Russia has talked again and again and again. There will be consequences. There will be consequences. There will be consequences. Yeah. Putin, in this speech, said, we're done. Here are the consequences. This is how we have responded. And he laid out at least 6, depending on how you count them, possibly 7 new weapon systems, most of them nuclear. And these are all the majority of what we're talking about are designed to get around U.S. Missile defense.
Yep.
And it has to be said that, when we're talking in terms of total strategic balance right now, the U.S. doesn't have anything that could prevent a U.S., a Russian response that would be equally devastating,
right?
But we're talking about the near future. We're talking about single missile fires, that could, possibly blow up, could be contained. We're talking about looking at a near future first strike capability and what Russia has done to prevent the U.S. from ever gaining that. Because that has something that military experts in the U.S., the more aggressive ones, have openly been talking about. That they're very salivating at the idea that we might soon have that they might soon have a first strike capability. They talk endlessly about it, and that of course is MAD, because that destroys MAD.
Right.
The mutually assured destruction, something that, many people might think is a relic of the Cold War, the first Cold War, and that ended, but, that was only put on hiatus in the 1990s, and it's at us again. Russia insisted in 2001 when Bush pulled out of the anti-ballistic missile treaty that, you are trying to break the strategic balance, and we will have to correct that. And we don't want a new arms race. Well, the new Cold War is here. if you want to call it that. I look at it more as great power struggle, but it's certainly here. And a lot of people after this speech are saying, oh, that Putin announced it. Well, no. The new arms race didn't just start, and Putin did not just announce it. He's just picking up the gauntlet, all right? I'm going to look just 2 weeks ago in the pages of the Washington Post, you know, the establishment magazine, an article by Katrina Vandenhoevel, who is the editor at The Nation. The Nuclear Posture Review signals a new arms race. Right, that's not Russia. That's the United States.
That's right.
And this is a big part of the speech. It's a reply to two things. This military portion is a response one to the laying out what we've done for you pulling out of the anti-ballistic missile. The other part of it, and it's very angry. It's very Russia's clearly signaling they're not happy about it, and they're basically answering back. The new U.S. Nuclear Posture Review, put out by the Trump administration. You know, there were some leaks of it before, but it's officially been put out in the last month, and it's been almost completely ignored in the Western press. Right, no one wants to hear it. Just even the name of it sounds boring, I guess. The Nuclear Posture Review. But this is extremely aggressive. It talks about decreasing the size of nuclear weapons, something that we know has already been done, but also about deploying them.
That's right.
Putting them on the front lines in Europe.
Yep.
In fact, training up European countries to use them as well.
Yep.
And indicating that they would use these mini nukes against conventional forces.
That's right.
Right. They're talking about a first strike.
They're talking about them being
conventional
used.
Forces.
Yeah, they're talking about them actually being used in the strategies that they're using for actual
and
engagements.
Using them first.
So we're out of time. I just want to say this part because Putin responded to that and said, listen, whatever you guys want to put down in your little books and whatever you have planned to do or whatever, if you attack us, we're going to throw everything we got at you. And we got all this stuff now. So you better listen.
Hypersonic weapons, underwater drones.
That's right.
Nuclear powered cruise missiles. We have it all now.
That's
It's much cheaper to build missiles that can evade missile defense than it is to build missile defense. If you want
That's
to make
right.
this an arms race, we'll beat you on cost. Now.
That's right. That's right. I mean, hey, look at the economy. Okay, Mark, thank you very much. Appreciate it, and we'll speak with you again soon.
Thanks for having me, Don.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.
Hello and welcome to Crosstalk, where all things are considered. I'm Peter Lavelle. Putin tells the U.S. to come back to Earth, challenging Washington's unipolar ambitions. Also calls to end the illegal war against Yemen and why arming the Kiev regime is a recipe for disaster, as well as the return to trade wars. Crosstalking some real news. I'm joined by my guest, Mark Sloboda. He's an international affairs and security analyst. And we have Dmitry Babich. He is a political analyst with Sputnik International. All right, gentlemen, Crosstalk rules in effect. That means you can jump in anytime you want, and I always appreciate it. First of all, we have to go to Putin's speech on Russia returning to nuclear parity with the United States. And we have to comment about the erosion of arms control regimes that are very important here. Mark, in looking at the major cable stations and the broadsheets, they don't give much of a background why the speech was given and its significance. Go.
Okay, well, there's two speeches. The first part of the speech was a domestic State of the Union speech saying, this is what I've accomplished in my years in office so far. This is what we haven't accomplished. This is where we want to go. This is our obstacles. And this is how we think we can get there. And it was a very good The majority of the speech, it was a two-hour speech, the majority of it was devoted to domestic matters, lots of facts and figures. He's clearly on top of his game, knows his economy inside out, knows where he wants to take it, focus on increasing GDP per capita and also science, technology, education spending. The other part of the speech was a reply to the U.S., it was a reply to two things. One, the U.S. unilaterally pulling out of the anti-ballistic missile treaty that was the bedrock of the nuclear parity global strategy of MAD, mutually assured destruction. And the other one was that pullout was under the George W. Bush administration back in 2001. Russia yelled about it at the time and said the measures they would take, and they've now announced them. The other thing was a direct response to Trump's new nuclear posture review, right, which came out a few weeks ago. We've talked about it on the show. It has almost been ignored in the Western press. A very, very slight amount of news, certainly nothing on the talk shows. And Russia's extremely alarmed by it. And they made clear how alarmed they are by it. And they made clear, reiterating their strategy. And I would say replying in kind to the U.S., to the aggressive.
Well, of course, it's spun completely differently, that Russia is aggressive on the international stage here. But Mark is absolutely right. If we look at the larger picture here, we had parity was out of sync. That was the entire purpose of these nuclear armaments agreements, to keep a sense of balance, to make sure there was mass assured destruction where you wouldn't attack another country on a first strike. Now, what the Russians have done with this speech and with the introduction of these weapons is to bring that balance back into place.
Absolutely. And I agree with Mark that Putin's speech was a response to that nuclear posture report in the United States. And I would like to point your attention to the fact that originally he was supposed to speak in December. He postponed the speech until now. Why? Because it was a response to nuclear posture.
They digested the nuclear posture, right.
And maybe I will disagree a little bit on nuclear parity. Russia is not seeking to have the same amount of nuclear weapons or conventional weapons as the Western nations.
Parity in the sense where you discourage the possibility of any kind of nuclear exchange.
The aim is not even to be able to annihilate the enemy completely. The aim is to have enough capability to inflict an unbearable damage, a dissuading damage. That's why Putin said that, showing all of these new weapons, Sarmat and the underwater drone, he says that we're not going to produce a lot of them. The aim is to have weapons that can overcome the American ABM defense can inflict the damage.
But, Mark, it's deterrence. It's all about deterrence. And that's what all of these weapon systems are all about. I mean, again, it's spun in a very naive, simplistic way. But these are all defensive measures.
Of course they are. I mean, defensive measures to get past the U.S. anti-ballistic missile shield, which Russia's worried about because of first strike capability, which U.S. geopolitical thinkers have been salivating at the thought and openly voicing that they now thought that they were getting near to a first strike capability. And he's not just replying to the pulling out of the treaty. He's replying to the deployment of anti-ballistic missile shield sections in Poland, in Romania, Alaska, California, South Korea.
In the sea.
He highlighted some 31 destroyers, a number of cruise ships that form part of the
Mark,
Aegis
system. Is it going to work?
Oh, is Russia's reply going to work? Oh, yes, of course. The reason why, this is a key to the new arms race. And for those who haven't been paying attention, Russia didn't start the new arms race. The new arms race has already been going on for two decades because of the U.S. pulling out of it. All the major powers, Russia, China, India, the EU, the U.S., have all been developing hypersonic weapons, underwater drones, all of these things. But it is much, much cheaper, easier to build and deploy missiles that can evade missile defense than to create new missile defense that can counter those weapons. You
know, just a lot of warheads does not resolve the problem. What we need are smart warheads. And I think, paradoxically, it was a conservative speech. Putin wants the world to return to the safety, to the period of safety.
Or, as he said, when the U.S. has to come back to Earth.
Absolutely. And he mentioned it in an interview that the United States actually destroyed the arms control system when they went out of the anti-ballistic missile treaty signed in 1972. The whole idea of the treaty was, it's a very American idea, you know, two cowboys are facing each other with pistols. None of them has a bulletproof vest, so they won't start shooting because each of them understands it's going to be death for him, right?
The importance of ABM, the Anti-Ballistic Missile Treaty, Mark, is that it was the foundation for all the other nuclear agreements, okay? The one that we have one as the New START agreement. But this is one of the things that was meant Putin didn't mention in his speech. He did reach out, made it very clear to sit down, obviously with the United States here, to negotiate a new generation of agreements.
That's
very important, something that wasn't mentioned by the mainstream.
That's very important. The Anti-Ballistic Missile Treaty was the foundation upon which these other agreements were built. Now, one of the reasons for Putin's announcement, and this is a direct successor to Putin's 2007 Munich speech, a speech that, in order to understand modern geopolitics, I think everyone needs to read. He warned of the consequences then. He's now warning what we've done and where we're at now. And both of these two major treaties, arms control treaties, the Intermediate Range Nuclear Forces and the New START Treaty, are due to expire in just the next few years, right? All right, one in 2019, the other one in 2021. So he's actually making a plea here. Sit down at the table. He said directly, you did not hear us then. Well, listen to us now.
Before it's too late. All right, let's change gears here, gentlemen. I made a promise to our viewers here that we would keep an eye on what's going on in Yemen, a grossly unreported story in Western media. Dima, we have a move in the U.S. Senate to call the White House to stop its involvement in the war against Yemen that's led by Saudi Arabia. This is something that we talked about last week, about the authorization of military force. Is it going to go anywhere?
I'm afraid the carnage is going to continue. And it's just unthinkable. You know, all the Western media is talking about East Ghouta, where you have, maybe a few dozens of thousands of people. In Yemen, you have 27 million people, and 16 million out of them have no access to potable water and insufficient food supplies. And they've been bombed by the most sophisticated U.S.-produced weapons.
We have to talk about a very systematic blockade here.
The blockade continues since November 2017. It has not been lifted.
Which the U.S. has participated in.
Absolutely.
Where does this come from? Is this a red herring here that suddenly Congress is waking up to its responsibilities about authorization of use of force? Essentially, they have the right to declare war. Where does this come from?
No. I'm afraid this is a partisan shot across the bow. First of all, Obama started this war
He allowed it to happen.
He participated in it, and Saudi Arabia never would have launched the war without U.S. permission and help, right? And constant arms supply and refueling in the air and C4 ISR, intelligence, special forces on the ground, drones, everything. U.S. has been knee deep in this. They're not just supporting, they're an active military participant. That was started by Obama. No one objected then. No one objected to Obama's proxy war in Syria. No one objected to his destruction of Libya, right? Now Trump comes along, continues. At this point, he's only continued what Obama has done. And suddenly Bernie Sanders finds the courage with another Republican, Mike Lee, to stand forward and say, we just remembered that we have congressional powers to declare war over the executive branch. It's a shame you couldn't remember that just last 2 weeks ago with the authorization of military force.
They're telling the world that they have some kind of conscience, but it won't have any impact on policy.
You know why they suddenly discovered this conscience? Because The Guardian suddenly reported that the Saudis are targeting portable water supplies. They are targeting schools and sometimes even diplomatic
they've been reporting that
offices, you know.
Yeah, but it's interesting. We have the
RT reported it before The Guardian. But before The Guardian reported it, there were no pleas like
well,
that.
We're always
it was all, and it was I, all and fake I, news. It was all disinformation from Russia.
I compliment RT for keeping an eye on there. 20 seconds, Mark. You know, finish up on Yemen.
Yeah, I'm afraid that this resolution isn't going to change anything. The war there is a quagmire. Saudi's knee-deep in it. Yemen was already the poorest country in the world, but Saudi Arabia, one of the world's now highest military spenders, armed by the U.S. and all the other Western powers, can't defeat
Well, it's interesting.
Yemenis
the Crown
people.
Prince is due to be in the United States on the 18th. I wonder how much Western media will cover the Yemen war when the Crown Prince is in Washington. We're going to go to a short break, gentlemen. After that short break, we'll continue our discussion on some real news. Stay with RT.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Okay, Damien, let me go to you. As I promised our viewers, not only would we keep an eye on Yemen, we're going to keep an eye on Ukraine because Ukraine is going to be very much in the spotlight this year. We have anti-tank missiles being sold to the Ukrainians by the Americans. Obviously, this is sending a number of messages. U.S. support of the regime in Kiev because Poroshenko is in shaky ground right now. The issues in the Donbass obviously have not been resolved. We know that legislation has been passed by the Ukrainian parliament that has essentially made null and void the entire Minsk process, which is not mentioned at all
and
in Western media.
And the rights of
media.
The Russian language in Ukraine, the West protested against in March 2014.
And we also see that, you know, that Russia is going to be steadfast in its position. It will not allow the people of the Donbass to be overrun by military forces. So the Ukrainian military is gearing up. Go ahead.
There were several outrageous events that happened this week around Ukraine. You're right. The American Javelin anti-tank missiles have been supplied to Ukraine. When Poroshenko's police razed to the ground the protest camping near the Ukrainian parliament, 100 people were arrested. More than in November 2013 when Yanukovych disbanded, basically swept out the first Maidan. But at the time, Yanukovych got threats of sanctions. Now Poroshenko is getting anti-tank missiles for that.
You have to be almost a specialist in Eastern European affairs in Ukraine even to know what you just said, Dima, because it gets no coverage whatsoever.
Absolutely. But there are also a few other facts that I just wanted to mention. The American negotiator on Ukraine, Kurt Volker, suggested to disband Donetsk People's Republic and Lugansk People's Republic. He forgot to mention that these entities would have never sprung up if it hadn't been for the U.S. support regime change in Ukraine in 2014. So it's the same story as in for example, Syria. Why is there ISIS? Because you supported the civil war against Assad. Why is there ISIS in Iraq? Because you invaded in 2003. If it hadn't been for the U.S. invasion in 2003, the Al-Qaeda and ISIS would have stayed in Afghanistan. And in Afghanistan, they were because you supported the Afghan Mujahideen against
the Soviets.
I'm glad
you mentioned that, Mark. You know, I don't want to talk about it in length because we'll do it later, but the Iraqi parliament passed a resolution that they want all foreign troops out of their country. Again, hardly any mention in the media whatsoever. Let's stay with Ukraine here. What's going on, Mark? What's the gambit?
All right. So these weapons, we're talking 37 launch unit, Javelin launch units, 210, are not going to change the balance of power in Donbass. As Obama, one thing he rightly noted was that if we give weapons to the regime in Ukraine that we back, well, then Russia will just give an equivalent to achieve a new parity to the people in Donbass.
What's the signal that's being sent by the Trump administration?
This is, first of all, it's a shot domestically against critics that Trump isn't hard enough on Russia. So he's trying to shore up his domestic base all the time with this. At the second time, the neocons know that this is a political signal to the Kiev regime. Now, the West has been arming the Kiev regime all along. since the Maidan putsch first happened in 2014. But it's usually been with Eastern European weapons left over from the Warsaw Pact stuff that the Ukrainians actually know how to use, right, have supply chains, logistics, and can fix them and so on. These weapons aren't going to change any type of military balance, but they're a political signal to Poroshenko that the U.S. has got his back for possible military a renewal of military action against Donbass and for ripping up the Minsk agreement, which has quietly gone away, and it's pretty much been acknowledged that it would lead to the collapse of the putsch regime to enact it and fulfill the political measures of actually sitting down with the leaders of the people in Donbass.
Again, if you take South Korea, you take Syria, and you take Ukraine, the last thing the West and its allies want is peace. Go ahead, Dima.
Well, the problem is that the West has been emboldening Poroshenko, and now Poroshenko is getting dangerous for them. He now has a bad gas conflict with Russia, the so-called Stockholm court ruling, which forces Gazprom to pay $2.56 billion to Ukraine, an absolutely outrageous, ruling, because Russia has been supplying this gas, Ukraine has been using it. So now Poroshenko says that if he doesn't get the money, he's going to arrest Nord Stream and stop all supplies by the North Stream.
That's certainly going to make the Germans happy, okay? The law of unintended consequences always happens.
Ruder and ruder, and Germans have no one but themselves to blame for that, because Germany and France, whatever their leaders say, have been supporting this regime all along. They helped Maidan regime to be installed more than the United States.
See, all of this talk about the Maidan regime and that there's fascists in Ukraine is just Russian propaganda. Except that you might notice that The Guardian finally noticed this week that the Ukrainian members of the Banderite fascist Azov battalion, now officiated with the police as an alternate law enforcement body
in
on the streets of Kiev, they are now in London. We might ask, what are they doing in London? Well, they're recruiting neo-Nazis on the streets of the UK.
Jeez, where's Antifa when you need them?
Actual fascists, right?
We had so much to cover here, gentlemen. Donald Trump says that trade wars are good and you can win them. Trade wars have a long history of ending up in a shooting war. And this is something that's very, very serious. I have to compliment Mark. The day before Trump was elected and after Trump, you said that this president and presidency would destroy relationships
with U.S. allies. Yeah. And Trump has already started the trade wars, right? He's already put high tariffs on solar panels and washing machines from China. He's making these moves now. He's putting a 25% tariff on steel, 10% on aluminum. And this is ironically not aimed primarily at China. China's the biggest supplier of steel in the world.
It has excess capacity.
Huge capacity. It makes as much steel basically as the rest of the world put together, right? And it exports most of it. The U.S. is the biggest consumer of steel in the world, which it makes a lot of steel, but it consumes far more than it builds itself. But the U.S. only gets 2% of its steel from China. Obama already put quotas and restrictions on it can get to China. This is a shot not at China. This is a shot at Canada,
Germany,
Brazil, South Korea, Germany. These are the big countries that supply steel and aluminum to the United States. And there's so many unintended consequences with this, because if he cuts steel in an vain effort to try to increase the steel industry in the U.S., it's going to raise consumer prices in the U.S. because now they have to import or buy more expensive domestic steel.
When you get your tax return, the middle class is going to have to use that tax return to pay for steel.
And you're going to lose far more jobs from manufacturing jobs than you would gain from steel plant
jobs.
The
thing is that there's going to be a lot of retaliation, okay? And once you start this, there's no way to know how it's
going
to end
here. What I especially liked was the reaction of the mainstream press to that, you know. Their usual mantra is that this is all Trump's initiative. This is his madness, you know. The New York Times wrote that Trump didn't listen to his Treasury Secretary, Steven Mnuchin, and just picked up every fight he could. Well, I mean, how different is Trump from the previous administration, which, driven by ideological reasons, right, picked up a trade fight with Russia? I mean, can anyone explain to me what is the purpose of all of these sanctions that the United States, the EU, and Russia impose on each other? None of them have changed the situation in Donbass.
It's right? just beating their chest here. One thing I think we have to tell our viewers here is that I think a lot of this is the... it's really the fruition of an entire policy, trade policy, the United States has had since the end of the Second World War. It made sweetheart trade deals with a lot of countries because of their geopolitical strategic value. We can mention all of Western Europe in the aftermath of the war, Japan, South Korea. Now, these countries are major competitors of the United States here. I mean, this was an intentional policy to keep them on board in the Western camp under the hegemonic rule of the United States. Now it's coming back to haunt
them. The roots of this are all the way back in Bretton Woods, right, and the foundation of the European Union and steel and coal. And it's the logical consequences of the construction of a neoliberal economic order to consolidate a world behind U.S. opinion, except now it's leading to the destruction of a manufacturing production economy in the U.S. and the siphoning of wealth out of the West to the rest of the world.
American allies are the engineers of economic growth, while the United States finds its relatively impoverished infrastructure. This is the logical conclusion of this policy.
The European allies, like I said, are actually small game, right, when it comes to the steel industry, right? And I think Trump has got his eyes set on a trade war with China. Next, we'll be labeling China a currency manipulator. But by picking this fight with the EU, they're actually fighting over the scraps. They're fighting over the scraps of the steel market
and export strategy. Well, it certainly gives the Europeans pause the thought. They're thinking about their own defense, their security. I think that's actually a good idea because they don't need to be subsidized by the American taxpayer anymore.
We do need to point out, however, though, that the Europeans have already put in a lot of measures that subsidize and protect their own domestic steel industries. So I'm not sure who really started this chicken before the egg.
Well, a lot of people asked me, especially in the 90s, why do we need multipolar world? Why can't it be just unipolar with the United States? Well, that's why, you know. Do you think they would have allowed Japan and South Korea to develop their own car industries in the 60s and 70s if there had been no alternative polar, in the USSR? No way, you know, because they would say this is our copyright, you are copying our car models. The same thing with Europe. Europe was allowed to become rich in the 40s, in the 50s, because the United States needed.
Because they were very, very poor. We have to remember, at the end of the Second World War, the United States was 50% of global GDP. Now it's less than 20%.
Europe was devastated by the war.
In the places like Italy.
Around this point, gentlemen, this segment ends. Many thanks to my guests here in Moscow. This is the end of our broadcast segment. Stay with us for the extended version on our YouTube channel. See you next time, and remember, Crosstalk rules.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR, CommunityPublicRadio.org. I'm your host, Don DeBar.